Session number 21052, Reel 1.
Charles Carrington, Reel 1. Where were you born, please?
In Derby.
Which year was this?
1924.
Did both your mother and father come from Derby?
My mother was born in Sheffield, strangely enough in married quarters. My father was born in Derby.
What did your father do for a living?
He was a nurseryman.
Did you go to school in Derby?
Oh, yes, yes.
Which one?
I went to St. James's Church Higher Grade School for Boys, which sounds rather posh, doesn't it?
How old were you when you finished your schooling?
14 and a half.
So this was just about the time the war started?
Actually, I left school in May 1939, about 6 months before the war started, or four months before the war started.
Did you get a job?
Yes, I went to work for a chartered accountant.
Did you hear Neville Chamberlain declare war on Germany?
Yes, I did. We had the radio on a beautiful sunlit morning, and we all listened to it with horror.
Had you not expected it?
We were expecting it. My father was a First World War soldier, and he said that he was quite certain that war was coming, and unfortunately he was proved correct.
Did the war affect you at first?
Only to the extent that I was already in the Civil Defence Organisation, and it suddenly became we had to go on duty rather than being when it was available.
Can you tell me about joining the Civil Defence Association?
Yes, I joined it in 1937 as a child, really, as a messenger boy in conjunction with the Boy Scouts Association. When the war actually started, they told me that I was too young to go on duty during air raids, which I thought was rather ridiculous. So I went down and joined the AFS instead. Unfortunately, again, when Manchester was being blitzed, they ordered the trailer pump to which I was attached to go to Manchester to help with the blitz. And just as they were going through the gate, the officer in charge stopped them and said to me, "Get off, you silly little so-and-so, you're not going with them." I got rather annoyed because they wouldn't let me do things. And in the end, I put a year on my age and joined what was then the LDV, in which I served as the Home Guard until the day I joined up.
What had made you join the Civil Defence Association?
I was in the Boy Scouts, and they put a notice round to say that the Civil Defence Organisation was becoming rather well organised, and they needed messenger boys. And in the First World War, the Scouts had acted as messengers, and anyone who'd like to do it again, would they report to the local office? So I went down and joined up.
What experience did you have with them before the war started?
Only before the war, only on training exercises in Derby. And when the respirators were issued to the civilian population, they had to put the anti-smoke canisters on the front. And I was one of the people who was fixing these and putting tape round to hold them in position. That's all we really did until the war started. When the war started, I was assigned to an ARP post and told to report there. And then the man in charge of the post arranged a roster of when I should be on duty, etc.
And with the auxiliary fire service, you didn't actually attend fires?
Oh, only in Derby, which, of course, in Derby itself, we were extremely fortunate. They put a smoke screen over the town, and so the German planes couldn't find it. Only one occasion did they find it, and on that occasion they dropped a few very, very small blast bombs, which overturned one or two of these smoke screen generators, and there was a diesel inside them that was burning, so of course that was on the roads, and the AFS just went round and put it out more or less in a few seconds. Apart from that, we didn't have any fires in Derby. Obviously, I attended training sessions to learn how to put fires out. And whenever there was a raid in progress, the pumps were ordered. Every time a plane went over the top, they moved round to the next post, so the whole of the town was covered every time a plane went over to see if there were any fires or damage. But as I say, fortunately, we didn't find much damage.
Did you attend those bombs that fell on Derby?
There was only about twice that bombs actually fell on Derby, and on both occasions the pump I was with was at the other end of town when they fell, so I didn't actually attend the actual incidents.
Whereabouts did the bombs fall in Derby?
The first lot fell in a street called High Street. Strange enough, there were three houses were hit. The two on the edges were completely demolished. The one in the centre, which was actually my auntie's house, appeared to be undamaged. But the next morning, the engineers came round and said the whole thing had been shaken that much. It was structurally unsafe. And they moved her out and demolished the house. And the second time, when they knocked these smoke screen things over, was in a street called Rose Hill Street, which was the other side of the main road from the street where I lived. So although it was so close to my home, I was on duty with the pump and I was on the other end of Derby when it happened.
What was your address at that time?
Lyndhurst Street in Derby. I lived at number 8 Lyndhurst Street. That's where I was born and that's where I lived until I joined forces.
Did any bombs fall near the key factories in Derby?
No bombs, no. One or two fighter bombers came over on several occasions and they knew when the shifts were changing at Rolls-Royce and at the carriage works and loco works, and they came down machine gunning as the shifts were changing. They killed one or two people and injured quite a lot more, and of course caused a lot of mayhem. But structural damage, there wasn't any. It was just machine gunning the workers coming out and the new shift going in.
Did this smoke screen create any problems for the population?
Well, if you can imagine diesels burning and the smoke billowing out of a small chimney, that smoke always settles down to the ground. So, for instance, where I live, there was a smoke screen right outside our house, and the house had cellars, and the whole cellar became full of the fumes of the diesel, which is a... It has a choking effect. It doesn't. It's not very pleasant. It's not really dangerous, but it just unpleasant. But I suppose it was a lot less unpleasant than being bombed, so we were quite happy to accept it.
Were people in Derby surprised that more bombing didn't take place on the city?
Surprised, relieved, certainly. We didn't want any bombs to be dropped, but we were expecting a lot more, because in Derby itself there were something like 14 or 15 factories which are actively engaged on vital war work, and we knew that the Germans knew this and would therefore want to come across and destroy what they could. This was the reason for the smoke screens, of course. Derby is in a basin, so it suited ideally for this smoke screen, because it all settled in the basin and the whole town was covered in you can only describe it as a thick fog, and which obviously protected us very well.
And was this all the time?
All the time. Whenever the sirens went off, the smoke screens were lit, so that the smoke was already there before the planes actually came over. We heard lots and lots of planes going over. We were overflown, if that's the right phrase, when they were bombing Manchester, Liverpool, Sheffield, Leeds, all those areas, that the planes came up and followed the hills to find where they were. And of course, Derby being right at the bottom of the hills, they all flew over us, but they kept going because they couldn't see us, presumably.
Were there many anti-aircraft batteries around the city?
Oh yes, there were quite a lot of Bofors, 3.7s, 4.5s. We didn't have any of the really heavy stuff, the 6-inch, but the others we had all quite, I should imagine, 30 different batteries around the town. And of course they were, on many occasions, they were firing.
Any other memories of what happened to you before you went into the army?
No, not really. It's as I say, there was one. Yes, when I was in the Home Guard, I was trained as a Lewis gunner. We had an exercise where the regular army were going to theoretically attack Derby, and the Home Guard was going to defend. Well, my number two and myself went into our little bunker, which was actually a railway buffer stop. And behind the buffers was an earth barrier to take the impact of any trains on the buffers. And we hollowed it out and made a hole so that we could fire onto the buffers. While we were there, the brigadier of the regular forces approached along the railway track, which he expected the Germans to come along, and he was about 5 yards off us before he realised that there was a gun poking through this little aperture. And he called us outside and he congratulated us on the camouflage. He said, "It's absolutely perfect, I couldn't see it at all. But you've forgotten one thing." So I said, "What was that, sir?" And he said, "You've forgotten your line of retreat." To which my reply was, "Well, if they got this far, Brigadier, we haven't got any retreat, we're dead. So we didn't bother with it." And he thought that was a fantastic answer. And he said, "Well, if this is the spirit of the Home Guard, we've got something going here." He was quite pleased about it, actually. But truthfully speaking, we knew that if the German forces had got that far, that they'd have just shot us out of hand.
What was the name of your Home Guard unit?
It was the railway, company of the Sherwood Foresters.
Where did you meet?
I worked on the railway then. I was in the divisional control office, and we had downstairs in the building, we had a room which was made into our guard room. And that's where we used to meet. For any drills, we used to go down to the drill hall. They had a regular RSM there who used to teach us how to do the various drill movements. And then, of course, for firing, we used to go out to the villages outside where there were rifle ranges that the troops used, mainly one at Belper.
Can you take me through the process of your joining up, please?
Yes, certainly. I was told when I registered that I was in a reserved occupation and I would not be called. Well, at that time, both of my brothers were missing, presumed killed. Their wives were being paid widow's pay. I was 17 and I said, "Well, I literally can't take this. I don't want to stay at home, to use a phrase, cringing on a reserved occupation when both of my brothers might have been killed." So my friend and I decided that we'd try and fight. We got the assistance of our boss, who was an ex-colonel from the First World War and therefore had contacts in the War Office. And eventually they told us that if we signed on for a regular engagement, we would be released. So we made a few inquiries and found a regiment that we thought was good, and we both signed on for 7 and 5. This was the end of 42 that we signed on, and we were called, ordered to report on 7th of January 43, a little bit older than the call-up boys because of this delay. And when we got to Fulford Barracks in York, there was a parade there, obviously, of all the recruits who'd attended, and they called the roll and detailed people to go to this platoon and that platoon. And when they finished, the two of us were still standing there, and the officer said, "Who the hell are you?" So we told him, and he looked down the road and said, "I've got no trace of you. You're not supposed to be here." So we produced our papers and said we are, and they put us in a platoon. We were the only two who didn't have a regimental number, and about a fortnight later they finally found out who we were and what we were, and so we became part of the regiment. That was 15 PTC. The platoon we were put to, there was a corporal there, never forget him, Corporal Wilson, which is a common name, and we had to scrub all equipment to be wiped. So this corporal took us out to the ablution room and brought out 3 scrubbing brushes, one for each of us and one for himself, and he actually helped us to scrub our equipment white. It was a fantastic offer on behalf of an NCO, and we really appreciated it. But when we were issued with kit, he knew that we both signed on as regulars, and therefore we got brand new kit instead of the second-hand kit that was given to the conscripts. We got brand new cap badges instead of the old ones, and we were really looked after by that man, and that's where we began to find the terrific esprit de corps which existed in the regiment.
How had you personally gone about picking a regiment?
Well, my friend's father had been in a KRRs, and he gave me a lot of information about them. My father had served in the South Staffordshires, and he wasn't particularly keen. He was only a conscript in the First World War, and he wasn't particularly pleased. My grandfather and my maternal uncle had served in the Coilies, so I was interested in those, and we started comparing records, which we went to the library and looked up, and we found that the KRRs, the King's Royal Rifles, had got the much better record, and so we plumped for that one. It was simply that we wanted to, if we were going to be regular soldiers, we wanted to join a decent regiment, and that was, in our opinion, the best of the lot, so we joined it.
And you had no difficulty getting what you wanted?
No difficulty at all. When we signed on, attestation papers stated wishes to serve in the King's Royal Rifles, and that's where I was born.
What do you remember happening next?
Well, when we reported to York, we went into training. Well, of course, because we'd been handling weapons, we knew something about them. We were always, one or the other of us, were always picked as the demo when they started to rifle drill, etc. We were taught both rifle and brass Broughton drill at that time. Of course, we knew all the brass Broughton drill, but we didn't know the rifle drill. We had quite a time. It was 6 weeks basic training there. And at the end of the 6 weeks, we classified as being half-trained recruits, and then we were transferred over to a Strensel camp just outside York, which was the 1st Motor Training Battalion of the KRRs.
Well, this brass button drill?
Brass button drill is the general drill of the army, where they slope arms and do things in a slow count. The rifle drill, I don't know if you know this, the rifles never sloped arms. They never use the words attention. All of their commands are different. All of their drill is different. We march at the trail in threes or at the shoulder in file. And therefore, all of our drill was based completely different from everything that the what we call the brass buttons used to do. Because, as you know, the rifles were all black buttons, even during wartime. It was rather comical, really, because on the steel helmets of the infantry, on one side they had the red flash, which showed they were infantry, heavy infantry or light infantry. The rifles, the King's Royal Rifles in particular, didn't have that. But on the front of the hat, we had a transfer of our own cap badge. And officers were saying to us, if you go in action and you're captured, you must never tell them what regiment you're in. And here we are going in action with a bloody badge on the front of the tin helmet. We didn't have to tell them it was up there, which rather tickled us. But again, even in action, we always wore black buttons on our uniforms, never brass at all. So any rifleman who was captured, the Germans immediately knew that it was in the rifles. I mean, they knew all about our structure the same as we knew about theirs. And it seemed rather ridiculous to us to tell us that and then send us in wearing a badge. But there you are, that's the way it went.
So, to pick up the narrative, Strensel Barracks, please.
Strensel Barracks, yes. We were put in intensive training to become real soldiers rather than half soldiers. It was a very, very tough regime. For instance, for 6 weeks, we had to double everywhere. We doubled on pay parade, meal parade. Everywhere we went, we had to double march. We had a route march every day of 11 miles. We started off in PT kit and finished up in FSMO with platoon weapons and rations and all the lot. And it was always the case, if you don't get back in a complete unit, if you don't bring everybody back, then you've got to do it again. So as a result, we had one of the lads in our platoon was bronchial. And obviously, when we were doing force marches, which is you run a quarter of a mile, march a quarter of a mile for the whole of the distance, and he was very, very quickly out of breath. So we used to split his kit up. We'd all take part of his kit. Two of us would grab his arms and put them round our shoulders, and we literally carried him back to barracks. So we all got back together, which again is the fantastic esprit de corps of that regiment. It's a wonderful attitude that your mate is in trouble, so you help him out. You don't just abandon him on the roadside. And then we had an assault course at Strensel. Now, we had quite a few men who had come back from either the paratroops or the commandos, and quite a few have been in both. And they said that apart from the specialist training, such as jumping out of planes if they're parachutes, or climbing cliffs if they were commandos, apart from that specialist training, that the training at Strensel was as strict, if not stricter, than they'd ever experienced in the commandos or paratroops. And it was really terrific. The assault course, we had two assault courses. One was of the beginners, and the other one was the full one. And the full assault course was absolutely horrendous, but we had to do it more or less every day for weeks until we got completely able to do it. Unfortunately, I suffer a bit from vertigo, and the beginning of the assault course, we had to run across telegraph poles over a ditch full of water. Well, I could never do it. I always fell off the side, is it? And first of all, the NCO thought I was putting it on to get out of the assault course, and he sent me back to barracks to get into dry clothes. Well, the second time he said, I don't think you're playing the game, you know, you're pulling my leg, so you can carry on and finish the assault course in your wet clothes. Okay, I carried on and I finished the assault course, and he said, perhaps tomorrow you won't fall off. And I said, well, I'm sorry, Corporal, but it's not me, it's my head. I've got vertigo, and when I got on that narrow pole, I can't balance, I just fall off. So he said, right, we'll cure that. And he got one of the lads to pick me up in a fireman's lift and carry me across. And I froze to such an extent of terror that I went in the water and took him with me, which didn't make me very popular, I tell you. So the next day, the corporal said, right, we'll try it a different way. And he ordered two men to pick me up, one at the shoulders, one at the feet, and carry me across. And I pulled both of them into water with me. And by now, I wasn't popular at all. Nobody in the platoon, we're not getting near you. So I was left on my own. And the only way I could get across there without falling was to get down on my hands and knees and crawl across. And in the end, the corporal said, well, you can do that, but you've got to catch us up because we're not going to wait for you. And so I crawled across, and I was so far behind, it was a killing to catch him up. So after that, I said to him, look, I know I'm going to go in the water, Corporal, so I might just as well jump in at the beginning. And I used to jump in and wade through. It was the only way to get through there. I never could do that across narrow bridges like that. But, as I say, eventually the lads realised that I wasn't putting it on. It was really the effect of this vertigo. And we didn't fall out over it. But, as I say, when we were doing the assault course, everybody kept well clear of me. They didn't want to know.
And then?
Well, when we'd finished the basic training, we, as I said, we had 6 weeks where we had to double everywhere. On the Saturday that we'd finished the 6 weeks, we were all put on fatigues. The corporal marches up to the MT standing area and found that we needed picks and shovels to do the work that we'd been detailed for. So he marched us back to the other end of camp to draw these things, and one or two of the lads started making ribald comments about NCOs in general, and him in particular. So he said, if there's any more of that, I'll double you all the way back to the car park. Well, of course, we laughed like hell because we'd just done 6 weeks doubling everywhere. And in the end, one of the lads made another comment. He said, right, that's it, double march. Well, eventually we arrived at the hard standing. We were all laughing our heads off, and the corporal was absolutely knackered. He was just about collecting on the floor. But we did it. Well, then when we finished that, we were put on motor training, learning to drive lorries, which occupied 1 month. We had to do written exams in the classroom about the workings of engines, etc., and the actual test. We went out to do the test, and in York there's a famous hill which is 1 in 4.5. They made us park halfway up the hill on a lorry we'd never driven before. They put a matchbox 1 inch behind the rear wheels and said, take off in second gear and don't knock the matchbox over. Well, we managed that, and then we had to turn round. We had to hit the top of the hill at exactly 30 mile an hour in top gear, come down the hill. When we came off the bottom, we had to be in bottom gear, but we weren't allowed to use either foot brake or handbrake, so we had to use the gearbox completely, which is damn good training for driving. I passed the test, so I became a driver. And then they said, right, the next specialist training, we'd like you to go as a dispatch rider. So once again, I was training. Now, that took 3 months training on that, and we used to ride the bikes all over the Yorkshire moors. We We took bikes where I didn't think it was possible to take them, up hills, down hollows, through rivers, everywhere. And again, I passed the test. And then they put us on six-pound anti-tank training. And they did that for about 6 weeks. And then they sent us to Catterick, to the artillery training college, to be taught the finer points of anti-tank work. That was about another six-week course. And when we came back from that, we reported back to barracks. And of course, having been on detachment, we'd only got one pair of boots, and all the studs were worn out, so we had to do them